My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me now and we will explore these topics and so much more with fascinating guests, authors, and experts who will guide us to Destination Unlimited. The question is as old as humankind has had the ability to think, reason, and ask. Is there a God? If so, does God care about us? Or is human life a mere accident? For centuries, these fundamental questions have been integral to every culture and religion the world has known and have not been answered save by faith. When it comes to finding answers about how the universe came into existence, God is simply another theory, a theory that many say is no longer needed. But in the new book, Proof of God, the Shocking True Answer to the World's Most Important Question, New York Times bestselling author Ptolemy Tompkins joins forces with internationally acclaimed astrophysicist Bernard Heisch to demonstrate that God is not only real, but it is science itself that proves this. Structured in 7 compelling chapters examining core features of our universe, including gravity, mass, and energy, Proof of God blows up the misconceptions put forth by recent anti-religion bestsellers and shows believers that far from being an enemy of their faith, science is, if anything, its greatest justification. But above all, Proof of God is a deeply personal narrative about a scientist's journey to understanding how God's fingerprints are all over our universe. Proof of God shows how science and religion both point to the same stunning and world-changing truth: God is real. My guest this week on Destination Unlimited, Bernard Bernie Heisch, is something of an anomaly, a respected, accomplished scientist who believes firmly and fervently in the existence of God. Many scientists disdain faith, as there is no empirical evidence of any of it, and many Christians fear science, which they believe contradicts their beliefs. But the truth, Bernie argues in this book, is that you can't understand the universe without acknowledging that the evidence of God is clear in the very makeup of our world. Science and faith are two sides of the same coin. In Proof of God, he sets out with the help of Ptolemy Tompkins, whose books Proof of Angels and Proof of Heaven have top bestseller lists, to prove once and for all that God is real. Bernard Heisch is an astrophysicist and author of more than 130 scientific publications. He was a scientific editor of the Astrophysical Journal for 10 years. His professional positions include deputy director of the Center for Extreme Ultraviolet Astrophysics at UC Berkeley and visiting scientist at the Max Planck Institute in Germany. Prior to his career in astrophysics, he attended the St. Meinrad Seminary as a student for the Catholic priesthood. He lives in the San Francisco Bay Area with his wife, Marcia, and their 3 children. Ptolemy Tompkins has been an editor at Guideposts and Angels on Earth magazine and is the author of numerous books, including Proof of God and Proof of Angels, and the collaborator with Eben Alexander on the New York Times bestseller, Proof of Heaven. Please join me in welcoming to Destination Unlimited, Bernard Heisch. Good evening, Bernie. May I call you Bernie?
That would be just fine. Thank you very much for having me.
And thank you for joining us tonight. This is a fascinating topic and something that I think really needs addressing and that I know our listeners will love to hear. So in Proof of God, Ptolemy refers to you as astronomer priest, referring to your formative years and path. Please share your early path with us.
Well, I came from post-war Germany, actually. My parents came over here in the 1950s to find a better future in the U.S. than they saw around them in World War II destroyed Germany. So I grew up in Indiana with a very fervent Catholic mother and the belief that there were things that I was destined to do. I had the feeling even when I was just a young boy that there were things I was destined to do. And these involved the Einstein's work on relativity, which I wanted to study and did study later when I went to college. And on the other side of that was the notion that I really wanted to pursue a religious course in life, that I wanted to understand not only the mysteries of science, but those of religion, and to see if somehow they could be brought to a reconciliation. Those are grand things for a boy to think about at age six, but I guess I must have had some good inklings of what's to come, because I followed that path for a number of years, going to a school called the Latin School of Indianapolis, where I studied with other boys to be in a preparatory path for the seminary. And then I went to the seminary, St. Meinrad Seminary, for a year when I was 18 years old and in college. Pursued that for a year, but then decided I really wanted to go to the science side of things for the rest of my life as my primary vocation, not giving up the priesthood, not giving up the spiritual side, rather, but augmenting that with my primary career being in astrophysics. So I transferred to Indiana University and got my bachelor's degree there, and then went on to get a PhD in astrophysics from the University of Wisconsin, and so on. So that's my essential background in a nutshell.
Did you have any regrets leaving seminary?
No, not really. There were certain advantages to be had by not being in the seminary, some which were, for example, girls. There were a short supply in the seminary, but I wanted to take my... Well, I wanted to sort of see how far I could go with that in college, and I actually found someone to marry in college, and it was it was a very different kind of life. But it was very satisfying to be involved in something at the highest levels again, even though it was not religious. I was now looking at scientific problems from the topmost perspective of the researchers in the field, and doing research myself. And so I was once again involved in things that I consider to be profound, and that's, I figured, a nice way to earn a living.
Now, the Roman Catholic Church and astronomy are not mutually exclusive, because the Church has their own observatory, correct?
That's correct. In fact, it would be a great surprise, I think, to most people to know that the Catholic Church actually runs a research facility on top of Mount Graham in Arizona. It has a very large telescope, and is a first-class research location. So the Catholic Church has this long history of being involved in astronomy, going back into the 19th century when the Vatican Observatory was founded, and discoveries were made concerning, in fact, an asteroid was discovered by the observatory. And the history of the Church involves a long tradition of searching for scientific knowledge about the universe. So that's kind of a surprise, I think, to most people, and a surprise to me, too, until I heard about it. And so, yes, there's a deep connection there.
And if I'm not mistaken, didn't the head of the observatory in Italy actually come out with a statement a couple of years ago about the possibility of extraterrestrial life?
I think so. Now, I'm not real familiar with that. I've seen a few allusions to it, but it doesn't surprise me, because I don't see that there's any conflict between anything the Catholic Church teaches and science with respect to life elsewhere. I think there would be no problem having that kind of a belief become part of the Catholic doctrine, because there's nothing that I can see or anyone else that I've spoken to can see that would argue against that.
A little different from the old days when the Earth was the center of the universe and nothing else mattered, and anything to the contrary would actually get you in a lot of trouble with the Church.
It could very much do that. Father Bruno was burned at the stake in 1600 for espousing the view that there is life on other planets in the universe. So, it was once a very dangerous area of investigation, but nowadays it's a more peaceful kind of route.
And your co-author on Proof of God, Ptolemy Tompkins, please tell us a little bit about his formative years.
Well, I guess if you really want to know about them, you should read the book that we wrote together. But Ptolemy was the... collaborator on the book by Evan Alexander that detailed his sort of week-long experience as a week-long not out-of-body experience as a near-death phenomenon. He was basically clinically dead for 5 or 6 days, and during that time he experienced a great deal of scenes and people and all sorts of things in the altered reality that he found himself in, which he took to be, I guess, heaven, or something at least that was beyond the earth, or beyond this earthly realm, shall we say. So the one that was responsible for turning this into a bestseller was Ptolemy Tompkins. So that's what he was doing just prior to my meeting up with him, and us deciding to collaborate on this new book.
And how did that partnership with Ptolemy unfold?
Pardon me?
How did that partnership with Ptolemy unfold?
Oh, that was a very, very quick unfolding. It was very, a very profitable one. He decided to come out to see me in California. We'd done some work together over the telephone, but he decided to come out and see me in California. And when we were able to get together at my house for a few days and hash things out and just talk things over, and it turned out to be a very profitable kind of experience. And we came up with a good draft of the book, and of course then ran it past our editors at Simon & Schuster. But it was a very pleasant experience to get to know him and to see how my kind of rigorous scientific perspective on things could be meshed with his rather experiential and sort of pop level explanations of his life and what he believed in and so on. The two actually meshed rather well, and I thought we covered a great deal of ground, both spiritually and just in terms of everyday life as a human being, and the collaboration that ensued from that.
Ptolemy describes your relationship and your conversations as that of student and you as teacher. How did you experience the creative process?
Well, I don't particularly like the idea of myself as a teacher. I feel that I'm taking on airs by calling myself a teacher. I'm not a teacher. I'm a scientist, and I spent a good deal of time investigating things that I think have great importance and that I think can make a big difference in people's lives. But by no means do I see myself as a guru. I mean, I see myself and Ptolemy as having gotten together to hash things out based upon a wealth of experience, but never any kind of teacher-student relationship, and nothing like that at all.
But the word dialogue would be appropriate.
That would be, yeah, that would be.
My guest this evening on Destination Unlimited, Bernard Heisch. He's the author, co-author with Ptolemy Tompkins of Proof of God, and we'll be back with more of this fascinating interview after these words on the OM Times Radio Network.
OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
This is Terry Van Horn, and I want to invite you to join me for my weekly radio show, Healing Light, on OM Times Radio every Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. On Healing Light, we want to bring love, light, and blessings into your world. You can find out more about us at www.healinglightonline.com. Blessings.
I wasn't prepared to be a caregiver to mom, but a little over a year ago, we realized she couldn't take care of herself without our help. And well, how could I not be there for her? I had no idea how hard it would be and just what I would need to know. Things I never thought of, like how to improve her mood and, even for me, ways to stay positive. Luckily, I found the Caregiving Resource Center from AARP. It had articles about the basics that got me started, but also information about the hurdles I was facing in this new role. I could even connect with experts and hear from others who had been in my place. I know this road we're on isn't an easy one, but I'm really happy to have the extra help for her and for me.
Caregiving Resource Center at aarp.org/caregiving. Articles, tips, and tools to help you both care for your loved one and care for yourself. This message is brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
And we're back on Destination Unlimited. My guest this evening, Bernard Heisch, he's the author, the co-author, with Ptolemy Tompkins of Proof of God, The Shocking True Answer to the World's Most Important Question. We were talking about your working relationship with Ptolemy before the break. When your collaboration was complete, what feelings did this experience engender in you?
Well, a great relief. It's always very personal and this is a very demanding thing to be putting your thoughts down on paper that you need to have. You need to express them as best as you possibly can for the readership to be able to follow you. It's quite challenging to have to go over something over and over again to make sure that you've got every nuance that is going to matter and nothing that you don't want to have presented that may not be in there. So it's a relief, put it that way.
And from reading the book, it seemed like a very personal journey for the both of you.
It was. I had not thought about doing this myself. In two previous books that I had written, I talk about some of the same ideas, but it's from the perspective of an author presenting his concepts of the universe and his ideas, with some discussion of my private life, but not integrating that in any way into the important concepts of the religious ones. But now with Ptolemy, we were taking my life. We wanted to concentrate on me. And seeing how my life engendered ideas that would be valuable to condense into a book. And so there was a lot of me personally and its relationship to the concepts that we then formulated in the book. And so it was it really picked my brain thoroughly. it was an experience, pretty much, not totally.
Great. Did you leave as friends? That's the question I must ask.
Well, after I threw him out, I think we're friends. Yeah, I think we're friends.
That's good to know. You alluded to the previous books, and one of them was called The God Theory. How did The God Theory come about?
Well, I knew that I wanted to write something about, I knew that I wanted to take some of my ideas about how science and religion can be compatible with each other, because I see so much argumentation on both sides that can turn rather nasty and negative. And unfortunately, that nasty negative can happen a lot on the science side rather than the spiritual side often. But here I was, with a career in science, and I know what science is all about. I'm not claiming I'm any great scientist, but on the other hand, I do know what science is all about and what constitutes scientific evidence and the whole process of proceeding professionally as a scientist. I know that. And so I wanted to use that background, that ability, that experience, to try to show how that could and would be compatible with ideas of God that I think are at least the enlightened versions of God. I mean, there are many versions of God in the world, all sorts of versions of God. Some of them are all love and light and holiness, and some are, go out and slay the infidels, which I think is an absolute bastardization of the idea of God. So there's a lot of God ideas. There are a lot of concepts of God out there, and some of them just don't make any sense whatsoever. They make no sense and are very... in fact, have a very bad influence on the world. So I want to present something that involved a God that I believe to be true, but that front and center showed that this God is not any kind of a worship-hungry entity, that this is a God that could love mankind, and probably does, and there's a concept of God that really is profound, both for our ordinary lives as human beings in this, on this planet, but also from the perspective of I'm trying to understand what this God has done. In the book, what I talked about, which was new, was my ideas about how creation came about, what creation is with respect to God the Creator, and what God is with respect to us. And it's kind of surprising what that relationship is. And that's what I think motivated the editor at Simon Schuster to talk about the shocking new insights into God. They are kind of shocking, but they're shocking in a very good way, and I'm sure we'll be talking about that for the rest of the show.
Absolutely. It's interesting that you talked about the way that certain religions present the impression of God, and it's something that I've always felt, and this is my opinion, obviously, just that the foundation of every major faith and religion basically is the golden rule. Take care of one another, love one another, support one another, not go out and kill, not go out and make one's religion greater than someone else's. And I think that when you take away and when you strip away the man-made, and I use man specifically because I don't think women would have ever done that, regulation and control that was installed in some of these faiths, in most of the faiths, and get back to that basic message of love one another, take care of one another, I think that's the message that that God would want us to really work with and know.
Yeah, I think the only real ultimate truth, the only real ultimate law that we have to follow is to be compassionate, to have compassion for other human beings, to have compassion for other living entities, such as animals. And I suppose if we ever encounter space aliens, compassion for them is they have compassion for us.
Absolutely.
It's not whether or not you obey some rule of the tribe that you're from. I'm using tribe loosely. That you have to go to church on Sundays and go to Mass, and there are certain things you have to do if you're going to be a member of this or that religion. I don't think God gives a hoot about that. But the only thing that really matters and is the origin of the laws that are the universal ones are compassion. We have compassion for other living beings, to treat each other with grace and with respect and kindness and everything else that implies. Those are the essential laws. Other things that vary from one place to another, from one time to another, they don't really matter, and that's not anything that God cares about, in my opinion. Who am I to say? But, you know, believe me if you want to, I would not assume God pays much attention to whether or not you obey the laws of the tribe. It's what the laws of compassion and love are telling us that we need to be attentive to.
I couldn't agree with you more, absolutely. Now, for those of us who are not scientists or students of physics or astronomy, let's lay a little groundwork, and I use the word lay in the layman's sense. Most of us know the fundamental building block of everything we regard as matter or mass is the atom. But to fully understand your work, we need to go deeper into the components and subcomponents of the atom. So please give us a little bit about the structure of the atom, its components, and its subcomponents. But use layman's terms, please.
Well, we could do that, but I think that it might be a little more profitable if I give a very, very quick view of that and then go jump into the main significance of this.
Okay.
We assume that we live in a world that's comprised of ourselves, of course, and everything else that we see around us on the planet Earth and out in the universe through the use of telescopes and whatnot that I and my colleagues, you know, have spent careers using. So we have this view that there's this world of material stuff out there, of atoms and molecules, subatomic particles such as quarks, energy. Energy is a physical thing, and energy can be converted into matter via Einstein's equals mc squared. So all these things have resulted in a worldview that gives us a very detailed, very, very rich and full concept of particles and fields and things like that that make up supposedly the physical universe. Well, that's wonderful, but I have come to the conclusion that that may be kind of a top-level view of things that really is not really touching the basic substance of matter. In fact, I would say that matter is probably something that is more or less imaginary. What I'm alluding to is that instead of having a view of the universe as consisting of separate things, you know, on the one hand, there being us with our spiritual nature, and on the other side, there is the structure of the universe as espoused by science, by physics and astronomy, of atoms and molecules and so on, I think that it's time to invoke Occam's razor, which is the notion that things, if you're trying to understand something, your best luck is to have the simplest possible explanation rather than something that's more complicated. It's called Occam's razor. And so you try to come up with something that is less complicated than an alternative, and you're most likely to find the truth where things are the most simple. Now, the simplest possible thing we could attribute to the simplest possible interpretation of the notion that there is us and our spirituality as spiritual beings and a material world that is not spiritual at all, it's simply an inanimate thing, I think it's possible to conceive of a cosmology that is only one thing, that there's only one thing that matters in the universe, only one thing, in fact, that exists in the universe, and in fact, only one thing that exists outside the universe, and that is consciousness. And the idea here is that consciousness is God. That God is not conscious. He is consciousness. He doesn't have consciousness. He is consciousness. That consciousness is the basis of God. And similarly, the consciousness that God has is then projected upon us, and we have it too. And in our lives as mortal beings, we have that same kind of consciousness as God, and that is our basic nature. And then finally, that the world of matter, which we regard as being something separate, sort of over the fence on the other side from spirituality, is the view that material concepts are the true truths. We can explain those just as well by simply saying consciousness creates them. And there's one level deeper kind of a point of view that I think will be profitable for us to explore in the future about the nature of matter as a consciousness phenomenon. So I'm proposing that consciousness is the one and only thing that exists. And this is a kind of a new idea in that, it's been taken for granted that obviously matter is separate from spirituality and consciousness, and that we have perhaps these two sides to our nature. And my view is that it's only all one thing, that God is a consciousness, is consciousness. and that the consciousness is projected upon us, and we live in a world that is appearing to be a physical world, but is probably a virtual world. It's the virtual reality that is being developed around us as games that people play on computers that is, I think, pointing to an analogy for what we ourselves are doing as spiritual beings living in a supposedly world, a supposed world of matter and energy, but a world that, in fact, is really a virtual reality comprised of consciousness and thoughts.
That's a lot to contemplate, and what we're going to do is we're going to take a little break, and we'll continue with this train of thought, because that's a kind of a mind-blowing expression that you're giving us. My guest this evening is Bernard Heisch. He's the co-author of Proof of God, The Shocking True Answer to the World's Most Important Question. Bernie, please tell our listeners where they can get the book and find out more about you.
Well, the book is called Proof of God. And it's available, it should be available at any bookstore, but you can easily get it on Amazon by just going online. And the website would be thegodtheory.com. That's thegodtheory.com. And so I invite listeners to go look those things up and preferably buy my book.
Okay, everybody, listen, hold on to your heads. I know we just blew your minds with a lot of information, and we'll be back with more of this fascinating conversation with Bernie Heisch after these words on the Om Times Radio Network.
You're listening to OTR-FM, part of the IOM Radio Network.
Are you in an interfaith relationship and thinking of getting married? For 18 years, Reverend Lori Sue Brockway has been creating personalized, loving, and romantic ceremonies for couples of all faiths and cultural backgrounds. Reverend Lori Sue's sensitivity to the needs of interfaith couples is reflected in the compassionate and inclusive way she addresses the concerns of parents and families. Reverend Lori Sue is also the author of several best-selling books on interfaith weddings and wedding vows. Selected as one of the top interfaith officiants by New York Magazine, Reverend Lori Sue serves couples in the New York metropolitan area and beyond. Find out more at her website, yourinterfaithwedding.com.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Every Tuesday on Living with Moxie, join Shefali Burns and Donna Martouge in conversations designed to take you to the next level, where we highlight ideas, resources, and strategies that provide you with the leverage you require to meet and exceed your business and personal goals. Each week on Living with Moxie, we will lead conversations related to success, achievement, fulfillment, and extraordinary, vibrant living. Are you ready to live with Moxie? Join us.
Hamilton was adopted from a rescue in 2008. I do not love him.
Hamilton the Pug's adoption story started at a shelter. Visit theshelterpetproject.org to find a pet near you. Brought to you by Maddie's Fund, the Humane Society of the United States, and the Ad Council.
And we're back on Destination Unlimited. My guest this evening, Bernie Heisch, he's the co-author with Ptolemy Tompkins of Proof of God, The Shocking True Answer to the Most Important Question. Now, before the break, Bernie told us that consciousness is everything, and that what we perceive in life is actually virtual reality. Pick up on that thought, Bernie, please.
Right, this is a thought that's a little bit hard to get your head around the first time out, but it begins to make a lot of sense when you consider that it takes away the question that puzzles people, has been a puzzle throughout the ages, of what does the world consist of? Why is there a world of matter that is seemingly separate from a world of consciousness, which we experience? So that what's happened is that the scientific community over the years has come to believe that the world of matter is the only one that's real, that's the only thing that is substantive, that is real, and that there's nothing to the other side of ourselves as spiritual beings. And on the other side of religion, why, there's a view that the spirituality is the only thing, and it doesn't matter where the world of matter and energy came from. It's secondary. It's not really important. I think what the truth of the matter is, and these ideas are still being developed, and not necessarily just by me. They're not really new ideas of mine. They go all the way back to the Vedanta, of ancient India. The idea is that there is only one thing. One thing and only one thing, and that is consciousness. That consciousness is everything. That consciousness is God. God is a supreme consciousness, and God within himself, has created a world made up of the consciousness that he himself has. And that world is one that we enter into. So look at it this way. Consider that God may want to experience himself or herself. One may want to experience what it's like to be almighty and what it's like to experience the creation that you can bring about by being almighty. Well, God, I think, is capable of doing that. And I think God actually needs to do that in order to understand himself. In order to understand what God is to himself, God needs to explore himself. Yet if he were the one and only thing that exists and nothing else, how would he ever get to know himself? You require an outside perspective to know yourself. And so what I'm suggesting, and again, this is not necessarily, this is indeed not, you know, an original idea of mine, but it's one that has been out for a while. The view is that God interjects or causes some of his consciousness to become part of living beings and to ensoul living beings with consciousness. And that consciousness then goes out into a world that seemingly is very real and rich and full of stuff, in order to experience life in that kind of in a physical environment, or in an apparently physical environment, What is it like to live in a world like Earth, where one has water and air and has competition and has other beings like oneself? The way that God would interact with these beings himself would teach God something about what he himself is and is what his almightiness is all about. So I'm proposing that we have a God that is consciousness. It is consciousness, so totally nothing but that. And that creative aspect of that consciousness can create worlds that are virtual worlds, but that, again, are nothing but consciousness, into which he himself can enter as a being of consciousness and experience that kind of life. And you might even argue that God evolves himself, that the principle of evolution applies not only to the world at large, but to God. And God uses a kind of theory of evolution to understand and to make himself even grander and better. I mean, perhaps God is not everything. Perhaps God is still an evolving entity of great magnitude beyond anything we can imagine, but is still in need of something to understand himself and to make himself even better.
You know, that's fascinating, because about 30 years ago, after I did a lengthy meditation retreat, the idea popped into my head that I was here to experience, to be the experiential extension, and I didn't use the word God, I said of everything, that we're each the experiential extension. That's what you're saying, that each of us, everything in creation, is the experiential extension of God.
Exactly, that's exactly what I'm trying to say. And that is how God, that would be the justification for God creating a universe, and perhaps many universes, and then entering into those universes, which may all be very different from each other, and experiencing very many different kinds of processes and happenings and choices that go along with that.
Now, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. The thing that is sort of original, not totally on my part, but it's sort of original, is that I've taken this view that some scientists are taking in artificial intelligence, and kind of recasting it slightly to be relevant to God. There is work now being done in artificial intelligence, has been for some time, and that suggests that by and by, somehow we with a sufficiently evolved or developed computer and sufficient hardware and software, we can create something that thinks. We can create a life form in a test tube, so to speak, or perhaps more realistically, a life form in a computer algorithm, that we will have computers that would essentially be living, because they have such knowledge built into them through software that we should regard them as having risen to our level.
They become self-aware.
Self-aware. And here's something about that is rather scary. The idea that we ourselves, you and I, talking here, are perhaps nothing but algorithms in a computer that are being played by some future computer geek in the 23rd century. Who knows? This thing is the most horrible conception of a human being I can imagine. It's sort of like the brain in the jar, the brain in the jar kind of picture. To think that we are not real at all, but we are simply algorithms being carried out on a huge, vast supercomputer somewhere. But then once the power cord is pulled, we disappear. Now, that is something that a certain number of scientists in the field of artificial intelligence are willing to consider. And I think it's the worst possible concept that I can imagine. But if you assume that instead of having algorithms and electronics, you have a consciousness, which is a reality, an artificial reality that's based upon consciousness, then this opens the possibility that the God that I'm proposing uses mathematical techniques to create universes, and the model is that the same one that we're exploring in the world of computers. So we are not computers, and I'm far from it. We are conscious beings, but the algorithms that we operate out from would be mathematical algorithms that are sort of akin to the software of a computer. So this takes the notion that we are something that is a derivative from, in this case, mathematics and computer science, and applies it not to electronics, but to consciousness.
Absolutely. So
I'm presenting that if you imagine a consciousness processing an algorithm within itself, the algorithm not being electronics, but rather being mathematics and logic, then God as a mathematician, which is another idea that's bounced around, makes sense. God, the consciousness, the being of consciousness with mathematics as the ultimate sort of reality that goes along with consciousness, that can be used to create a world, a virtual world that we then enter into as ensouled beings. That begins to make a lot of sense to me, because then we only have one thing that constitutes reality, and that's consciousness, and consciousness acting upon itself to give us a world that is a virtual world that seems totally real to us. But in that world, we experience things that are like sort of a schoolroom, a school classroom, experience things that this virtual world sets up for us to enter into and to live in and to make a better or a worse place. It all becomes a matter of consciousness and enabling reality of mathematics and computer science to show how consciousness could be acting in that kind of a way to create these seemingly real worlds that we live in.
It's fascinating, because if you think about the mathematics of the universe as we perceive, our consciousness perceives the universe, there's a lot of mathematics in play, including the golden mean, which is found throughout nature.
Indeed. In fact, there is a book out I would encourage listeners to look at. It's called Guide the Mathematician. It's by an astronomer at the Space Telescope Science Institute. And it does talk about the possibility that ultimately God's consciousness is a matter of mathematics. That mathematics is, and that answers a question, by the way, that's also puzzled mathematicians and scientists for a long time. Why does the world, by world I mean not just our planet, but the universe too, why is the world so mathematically perfect? Or why does the universe evolve in such an ordered way based upon mathematical laws? And the idea here is that God is essentially a being of mathematics. It's his ideas about logic and mathematics that are part of his consciousness that makes it possible to create a virtual reality that's not an electronic one, like the recreation of your consciousness and mine in a computer, but rather that those laws of logic and mathematics, when they become energized by the consciousness of God, they enable a world to exist. And that world seems as real as it can possibly be, and yet it's mathematics and computer software and the thoughts that lie inside a great consciousness that is the seed of it all.
Absolutely. This is truly fascinating to me. Let's you know, we have a couple of minutes left in this segment. Let's get back to science as we know science in our consciousness right now. Let's talk a little. You mentioned about universes, multiverse. Now, astrophysics and science has started to get into the idea that there are more than one universe that besides our observable universe. What does that mean to you?
Well, I'm very happy about that because it does open the mental thought process of science. Say, well, gee, maybe there is more out there. You know, when I was a kid, back in age 6, 7, 8, and was reading astronomy books, what I found in those books was the notion that, well, you know, there's probably no other life in the universe. You know, we're it. Well, that certainly changed. I mean, now here we are several decades later, and the Kepler telescope, the NASA Kepler telescope, has now detected over 2,000 or 3,000 other planets around orbiting other star systems. And it's now the mainstream view in astronomy that, of course, there are other planets out there. The current estimate is there may be 100 billion planets in our galaxy, maybe 100 billion planets. And that's not a joke or not something that is an extrapolation of nonsense. That's what the interpretation of NASA data is telling us. And so the view that we are alone has been overtaken by the view that we have now evidence for lots of other planets in the universe. So that changes the game. That changes the game a lot. So we now have no problem. We have no problem adopting the idea that there are other realities out there, other worlds, other beings.
My guest is Bernie Heisch. She's the co-author with Ptolemy Tompkins of Proof of God, and we'll be back with Bernie and more of this fascinating conversation after these words on the Om Times Radio Network.
Humanity Healing International is a small nonprofit with a big dream. Since 2007, HHI has been working tirelessly to bring help to communities with little or no hope. Our projects are not broad mandates, nor are they overnight solutions, but they bring the reassurance that no one is alone and that someone cares. To learn more, please visit humanityhealing.org. Humanity Healing is where your heart is.
Change and growth are part of natural life and also part of your spiritual life. Everyone needs support and guidance, especially during life passages. Upgrade yourself with the Om Times Experts program. With Om Times Experts, you have access to the best intuitive coaches, spiritual teachers, counselors, astrologists, and oracles. Our team was carefully selected so you can trust. Find out more at experts.omtimes.com.
180 over 111, and I had a stroke. I couldn't speak or walk.
This is high blood pressure. Get back on your plan. Go to loweryourhbp.org. Brought to you by the American Stroke Association, American Medical Association, and the Ad Council.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest this evening, Bernie Heisch. She's the co-author with Ptolemy Tompkins of Proof of God, the shocking true answer to the world's most important question. So we're talking about God as consciousness. We're talking about everything that we see, know, feel, experience as the experiential extension of God as consciousness, of God finding itself, knowing itself. Let's talk a little more about science, because I think this is some of the stuff we have to touch on. In Proof of God, you mention inertia and how it comes into play. How does inertia fit into what we're talking about?
Well, that's a bit of a side topic, actually, because what I did was to talk in the book about some interesting aspect of my life back when I was doing research at the Lockheed Palo Alto Research Laboratory. And I had a theory that try to explain the origin of mass in terms of a phenomenon known as the zero-point energy field. And that was a very interesting project that we worked on, and it could have been really revolutionary because it opened the possibility for very, very advanced propulsion systems and so on. I mean, it's really science fiction kind of stuff. Unfortunately, the mainstream scientific community was rooting for a Higgs field to come along to take on the job of creating mass. And the Higgs field has now been discovered. It was discovered about 5 years ago or so. And so the view that I had that I developed with NASA funding about the inertia being connected to the zero-point field is put this on the back burner and see how far the Higgs particle can go in terms of explaining all this. So that made for an interesting story that I covered in book one, the God Theory. But it's not particularly relevant to the notion that we're discussing now about God as a being of consciousness. So it was a neat kind of investigation, and it may yet turn out to be something that could have a profound impact on technology if we could manipulate gravity and inertia, which is implicit in the theory. And then that opens up lots of possibilities. But right now, we hold that in abeyance and deal with a few of the more fundamental ideas like the Higgs particle.
Now, what about the fact that you can have two particles, the same particles, in different locations, and if you act upon one, the other one reacts in the same way?
Well, this is part of what's coming out in mainstream science. It really argues for a world that's not the logical, rational one that we see every day around us, but that there's a deeper reality here that I think is ultimately spiritual in nature. But stepping back away from this as a spiritual thing, what you're referring to is the notion of entangled particles. It's possible, and this is real honest to God physics, and it's been done, it's possible to have two particles, say two electrons or two photons, to interact with each other in such a way that they have complementary, that they have certain quantum properties that are that are the same or different between the two of them. So if, for example, one has a thing called spin, as if a particle were spinning, that idea is one from quantum physics. Doesn't mean the particle actually is spinning, but it acts like it does. Putting aside what the spin actually means, the idea is that you can create two particles in which one has a spin up and one has a spin down. Now, the idea is that if you have these particles be entangled and you don't know which of them is going to have a spin up or a spin down, you let them separate from each other and you act upon one particle to make your measurement that this particle is in a spin up state. Well, as it turns out, the other particle, no matter how far away it is going to take on the appropriate opposite state. It's been measured that what you do to one is going to wind up interacting with the second one to make sure that the two are complementary with each other. Now, that seems to be an impossible thing to do according to relativity because particles can't communicate faster than the speed of light. And yet this kind of communication between particles is one that seemingly takes place almost, well, as far as we know, infinitely fast. So there's something really strange about this. A direct conflict between quantum mechanics and special relativity. So there is a deep evidence here that something is at work beyond simply the ordinary mechanical laws of nature, but rather that the concept of making a measurement on something, which is a consciousness process, is involved in making a physics experiment come out one way or the other. And it's kind of mind-boggling.
So here's another justification for the concept of God being consciousness. And you talked about the word entanglement, and I'd like to use the word that Jung created, synchronicity, a lot, because I've experienced many what I would call synchronicities in my life. And when I use the word synchronicity, I'm talking about something that happens that some people might call a coincidence, but is just too dramatic for a chance to be at work, that there has to be some motivating energy or consciousness behind it. What do you think about that?
Well, I think so, and I think that the quantum mechanics experiments that have been carried out in recent years are definitely pointing to the effect of consciousness on physical experiments. I mean, it's right there in the physics laboratory, and it's been developed by people like Niels Bohr. The Niels Bohr interpretation of what happens when you make a measurement on the quantum particle, is pointing directly towards the fact that consciousness is what makes that measurement actually come about. If you don't have consciousness available to make measurements, no measurement comes about. And you can influence the motion or the properties of one particle by acting upon its mate, which has been created as a mate by virtue of entanglement. And that's just not an idea that's at all compatible with mainstream classical physics, and yet it comes about from quantum mechanics, which is an established field. It is an established discipline, in fact, a very accurate one. Some of the measurements that have been made in quantum mechanics are far more accurate than those we have from a physical constants. So there's certainly within quantum mechanics deep evidence for the role of consciousness in making everything happen.
Absolutely. Now, I'm going to give you one question, and then I'm going to follow it up with a loaded question, so be prepared for this. First of all, let's talk about the Big Bang. Give us the layman's explanation of what the Big Bang was.
Well, about 13.7 billion years ago, the universe, this is a mainstream view, I know one I don't disagree with, I think it's correct, that the universe was a sort of a tiny ball of something or other, of energies, and I say energies because there are several laws of nature that have different energies, different energy properties from each other. There's electromagnetism, gravitation, the strong and weak interactions. So without going into those at all, it's not necessary. I can say that at the very beginning, I assume that these laws were all probably one. They're all one and the same, and they got differentiated by virtue of the expansion of the universe. But the universe itself was this thing of unknown size, probably quantum on a quantum scale. It was a tiny, tiny thing that somehow exploded and then began rushing apart. And out of the remnants of that explosion, not so much the remnants, but out of the stuff of that explosion, there were condensed matter, which should be formed galaxies, and galaxies contain stars, and stars then developed the planets orbiting around them. It all came about because of this great explosion 13.7 million years ago. Well, I agree. That's how the universe seems to have gotten going. In fact, that's probably, if I were God and I wanted to make a universe, I'd do it that way. Because it used to be believed that the universe was probably infinite in age, that it never had a beginning and never will have an end. But now we know that it did certainly have a beginning, but we see the remnants of that beginning. We see in the sky the remnants of that explosion, and it was first measured 30 years ago, and we now know for certain that that's what we're looking at when we make measurements of the of deep space.
Now here comes the follow-up question. So Genesis 1:3 relates that God said, "Let there be light." Now, how is it that those who composed Genesis, and scholars say that happened somewhere between 7 and 12,000 years ago, depending upon whose school of scholarship you look at in terms of the biblical history, how could they know what we describe today as the Big Bang unless this was part of that consciousness?
Well, I guess I don't know. I'm not all that persuaded by there being anything profound in that statement, because light is certainly, it's something we experience every day. Everybody experiences light from the sun. And so, and the role of light in our lives is pretty evident. You know, we can go out and get suntanned in it, or we can go out and use it to, well, the sun is just a part of our everyday lives in a deep kind of way. And so to say that light was at the beginning, yeah, it turns out to be correct if you translate the energies of the Big Bang into the word light, because light is an energy, and so are the energies of the Big Bang. And so, yeah, in that sense, you can say that, you know, one implies the other. But I'm not so sure that the ancient authors of this had any deep knowledge, because to them, the sun going across the sky was probably sufficiently impressive that they would make a universe creation depend upon it somehow. Now, on the other hand, if you want to get kind of touchy-feely about this, I guess I would say that if you look at another book in the Bible called the Haggadah, mm-hmm. which I think a collection of things that were written that didn't quite make it into the Bible, it actually says that in the beginning, God made the sun, the moon, the stars, etc., etc. And, of course, the problem that it had was that it put the creation of light, or, you know, light ahead of the creation of the sun, moon, and the stars. So it's kind of a wrong direction for the causation to flow, because they've got it backwards. So I'm not too upset by that either, because I don't really put much stock in Genesis telling me anything about cosmology. But interestingly, in the Haggadah, it says that the light at the very beginning was not the same as the light from the sun, moon, and the stars. It was a different kind of light that would be discovered someday. And that caught my attention immediately, because that almost implied, well, even they back then they knew nothing about the zero-point field, yet here's a reference to a different kind of light than that came from the sun, the moon, and the stars. Wow, that's potentially interesting. But it doesn't go any deeper than that. And so, you know, apart from a kind of a wow effect when I read it, I don't see that there's much to be pursued in terms of, you know, trying to link up this with one short reference in the ancient literature of spirituality with anything in modern physics.
I get a little touchy-feely about these things sometimes, and I have a sense that some of these people actually had a feeling for a sense of what had happened in the very beginning. What would you like readers to take away from Proof of God?
I would like readers to go away with the idea that religion and science... Not religion, I should say, spirituality and science. I want to differentiate the two, because spirituality is a good thing, and religion is not necessarily a good thing, because of the evidence that we see around us, what religion can do to mankind. But what I want people to come away with is the notion that, yes, that spirituality and science are not at odds with each other, that when properly interpreted in a rational way, they support each other, and that indeed it's possible to conceive of a God that is a not the kind of God that you know, scares children at night and raises the bar for people to kill each other and slaughter each other. That's not the kind of God that we need, or the kind of God that could even possibly exist, in my opinion. But that the God that does exist, that is compatible with science, is one that is not just made of, but is consciousness, and that consciousness is the same stuff that we have been given, because we are extensions of that God, and that the entire universe is probably an extension of that consciousness, and it creates worlds, and worlds are created therein by virtue of the creativeness of the consciousness, the creativeness and the laws of mathematics and logic that make this great, you know, this great being God, the Lord of the universe, the Lord of the universe is. So to come away with the notion that there is a God, and that God is not in any way incompatible with science, but in fact the two are going to be very closely joined in the future.
And Bernie's proof of God are in the book, so you got to get the book to read the proofs. My guest, Bernard Heisch, he's the author of Proof of God with Ptolemy Tompkins. Bernie, one more time, please tell our listeners where they can get the book and find out more about this work.
Well, you can get it at any bookstore, I would assume, but if you want immediately, I would say in a line, go to Amazon, and you get a good price there.
And your website, sir?
And the website is thegodtheory.com. Again, thegodtheory, all run together, .com.
Bernie, thank you so much for joining us. This is absolutely fascinating work.
Thank you, Victor. It's been terrific.
And thank you for joining us on Destination Unlimited. I'm Victor the Voice Furman. Have a wonderful week.